I'm delighted now to welcome to the program award-winning filmmaker Ken Burns. He's the co-director and writer of the new documentary, The Central Park Five, which opens today at the CCA. There are showings this afternoon at 12:30 and then at 8 tonight, and those showings are going on through the weekend and also into next week. Welcome, Ken Burns, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is an extraordinary documentary. It is, to me, it's just a profound portrait of the United States. It's about five men who, as teenagers, were convicted of the horrible assault that probably some of us remember of a jogger in Central Park in New York City. All of them were innocent, and the film is about their story. How did you come to make this film?
Well, basically, it came through my daughter, Sarah, who became aware of the story that, as you say, almost all of us who were adults at that time, 1989, remember. It was a crime that shocked not only New York, but the entire country and indeed the world. She caught up to it much later and was so outraged by the story that it sort of kindled an interest in writing a book, which she worked on. And her husband, who's worked with me as a producer, David McMahon, and I had the great privilege of looking over her shoulders several years ago as the first pages were coming out, and looked at each other and said, this is also a film. And many of my films explore the heart of who we are, asking a deceptively simple question, who are we? Who are those strange and complicated people who like to call themselves Americans? And more often than not, the themes that get engaged are questions of freedom, questions of race, questions of justice. And so this story of the Central Park Five is a story that's just firing on all cylinders, I'm sorry to say, because, of course, it is the story of the blasted youths of five innocent teenagers.
Indeed. And it's so interesting because, I mean, 1989, the 80s New York was a nastier place then than it is now. Not that it's heaven now, but there were thousands of murders every year. Why was this one such a sensation in the media?
Well, first of all, it wasn't a murder. It was the rape and near murder a blonde woman jogging in Central Park. It seemed to be the apotheosis of all the crime of the 80s, the crack epidemic, all of the racial violence. But here, what happened was is that this normally progressive northern city suddenly morphed into a southern Jim Crow city of 100 years before, beginning to use the familiar words of the Jim Crow era South, the lynching words of brute and beasts and wilding and all of this stuff that they apply to these kids who were innocent of this actual crime. The woman, an investment banker from Solomon Brothers, actually recovered and has no memory of the event. And it was not unreasonable that the cops and the prosecutors might think that these kids were involved. They were in the park. They were with a larger group of kids who were making mischief that night. But their inconsistencies, their inability to, you know, place anything accurately about the crime scene, the fact that it was a very bloody crime scene and there was none of the crime scene on the boys and none of the boys on the crime scene, should have at least permitted these supposedly professional detectives and prosecutors to entertain an alternative narrative. If they had, they had the guy already. They had not followed through on a lead with his name on an assault 2 days before the April 19th assault on the Central Park jogger. This person, Mateus Reyes, went on to rape and murder that summer, was eventually caught by civilians. And many of the detectives were working both cases, and they could have easily walked the DNA sample over from this other case, the East Side rapist. He was called, whose MO was all over the Central Park jogger case, and it would have completely exonerated the boys then. But no, they had to follow through. The train had left the station. Their reputations as cops and as detectives were on the line, and ultimately these five African-American and Hispanic boys paid the ultimate price. They went 13 years for one who was 16 years old. The others, who were 14 and 15, spent upwards of 7 years in jail. And still, once the real rapist came forward, he bumped into the oldest in this maximum security prison in upstate New York and confessed and went to the warden, and his DNA matched. They had their convictions vacated a decade ago. But they've spent nearly a decade trying to get some justice from the city of New York, and the city refuses to settle. So what happens is that you have this horrible wound. A scab is sort of formed, and the city keeps picking it off, and there's no attempt at closure. And so what happens is we have this long-term object lesson in all of the aspects of American history that go back to the Civil War. We're watching Lincoln these days, to the issues of slavery, how a free country can tolerate that, how we judge people based on the color of their skin and not the content of their character, as Dr. King. And all of this is invested in this story of these five kids who are now, you know, men in their 30s.
It's such a story, and it's unfortunately it's not a unique story. This kind of thing is happening all the time. It's happening as we speak.
Exactly.
And so, I mean, the thing that is made so clear to me is while we have checks and balances in our system of government by having the three branches and all that stuff, we do not have checks and balances between the power structures and the citizens, except for the possibility of lawsuits. But even in this case, there's not really a check or balance.
That's right. And, you know, the expression, fighting City Hall, you can't fight City Hall, that doesn't mean that they're going to do something evil. It just means they know how to slow this thing down. And so the civil suit that the five launched in 2003 is now 9 years old, over 9 years old, and nothing's happened. And that is justice delayed, which we know is justice denied. And this comes on 13 years of justice denied, where these children had their, you know, as one said, couldn't go to the prom, couldn't, you know, be married, have a job, a real job, a home maybe, all the things that all the rest of us take it for granted, these aspirational things that are born in our teenage lives. And we work, we seek to find fruition in them. This was all denied them. And we look and we say, look, what can we do differently? These kids were not in trouble. They were good kids, so they did not know how to Miranda up, how to invoke the lawyers and not testify. They were trying to cooperate, and after 30 hours, with seasoned detectives wearing them down, and they say, look, we know you didn't do it, but this other guy is saying we think he did it. If you just confess to that, that you saw him do it, we'll let you go. And, of course, it was a circular firing squad, and they all woke up saying they just confessed to this crime that they didn't do, and they said, wait a second, we didn't do this, we recant our confessions, but it was too late. The jury just saw that, ignored the lack of DNA evidence, ignored the lack of all the contradictions in the case, just ignored everything, looked at the convictions, confessions and the coerced confessions, and said, send them away. And we felt it was the crime of the century, Mayor Ed Koch said at the time, and it was a different New York. New York is now the safest of all cities. Per capita, it's safer than Santa Fe. And back then, it was the most dangerous city, period, full stop. And this was the last of the big crimes. So the kids were sort of literally one of those questions of, you know, sent away, throw away the key and forget about them. And then all of a sudden, 13 years later, it comes back on the radar screen. And those cops and prosecutors can't admit a mistake. Their careers have been made on this case. So what you end up with is institutional protectionism, as Jim Dwyer, a newspaper reporter, says in the film.
It's a perfect storm of systemic failures all around. I mean, as you
exactly.
said, the real rapist later confessed. He was right under their noses. The press, and not just the tabloid press.
Everybody.
Everybody. They didn't point out the problems with the case. The police and prosecutors were using lies and tricks and coercion. And you wonder what their motives are. I mean, it's like nobody was seeking the truth. The kids had inadequate defense. The jury didn't even do their jobs. So, and as you say, it's like this Jim Crow thing. And what is at the center of it, which I think is so important to talk about, is the total devaluation of the lives of young, darker-skinned men who are lovely, beautiful people and who the sort of quote-unquote mainstream America can't even see as human.
This is the first time they've been able to really tell their stories. And film has a kind of polygraphic quality. You know, this is the first major film I've done without any narration. And the most sort of rigorously journalistically pure, insofar as it's possible to just let the story tell itself. Mm-hmm. And over the course of this, you could go in familiar with the case, thinking they're guilty, and they prove their innocence by the force of their being. regardless of the fact that the evidence also, you know, convinces you of their innocence. And the district attorney at the end joins with the defense and asks for a vacation of the convictions, which is granted by a judge in the nanosecond. But it's also polygraphic in another way, insofar as you can see the prosecutors and the police. They look like they don't have the right people. They know in their gut something's wrong. And the train has left the station with their theory, and the truth has left the station going the other direction. And they know it. And it's written all over their faces. And they still know it. And they still can't admit it. And so at the end, as you say, it brings in questions of race. It brings in questions of America and all of these complicated things about justice and freedom. But at the end, it's a very simple thing. Some people made a mistake, and they can't let go of that mistake. We all know what it is to lie. Everyone within the sound of my voice has lied. We all know what it is to sort of try to cover that lie up. And we know how much energy it takes. And this has been going on now for 23, 24 years. And we're sort of waiting for that point when this is, you know, closure in this thing will be incredibly helpful to these five suffering young men. It will be incredibly helpful to their families. But it'll be helpful to those prosecutors and police who steadfastly maintained that they were just acting in good faith. You don't hold a 14-year-old in 30 hours of interrogation and get a confession that is riddled with complications and don't actually get the right guy by acting in good faith. And once everybody comes clean, then the healing process has a chance to take hold. And we hope that in some way the film is a larger rallying cry. And we're so excited that it's opening in Santa Fe, 70 other cities around the country, to get people to say this is not just a New York story. It is called the Central Park Five. But as you pointed out, this happened yesterday. It's probably happening today. And it will happen tomorrow. And who are we? What are our responsibilities? Can we just say, oh, that's a nice documentary. That's really chilling. I'm very outraged. I'm very upset. Well, what do we do? Can we go and suddenly demand that we teach everyone what their rights are? That we say, if you're going to videotape a confession, why don't you videotape all the questioning? So if that jury had privy to those 30 hours of intense interrogation before they made their so-called confessions, they would understand all those tricks that were used. And we want our cops to be able to trick real criminals into admitting their guilt and telling us where the body is or telling us how they did it or telling us what's, you know, where the bomb is. That's an important thing. But you ought to be able to, as a professional, entertain alternative narratives. And when these kids have so many inconsistencies, when they're obviously scared out of their mind, and you don't see that, all you see is some other. And they're the ones that made up the term wilding. They're the ones who leaked to the press that they were just joking about it. They're the ones who called them beasts and brutes. And the papers picked up on this and in the most shameful way became complicit in what was almost a lynching. I mean, Donald Trump took out full-page ads in all of the daily newspapers in New York asking for a restoration of the death penalty. Because there was not a skeptical press, as there had been in the early 60s when an African-American man was charged with a murder that he didn't confess, and the newspapers themselves did the due diligence, that led to Miranda. This led to the death penalty being reinstated in the state of New York.
Right. And it's the kind of thing, I mean, I think another, when we talk about you and in your life's work, making one after another portrait of America and of who we are and holding a mirror up to ourselves. I mean, this is the mirror that says Jim Crow was not just in the South. Jim Crow is all around us and still is.
It says what Dr. King says, is that there's still a promissory note owed for those people that we tend to say, those people. You know, we look at them as other and we don't see them as human beings. And it was our intention, Sarah and Dave and my intention, to just sort of ask a question, first and foremost, what happened? And secondly, who were these people who were charged with it? And that's it. That's what the film is attempting to do.
Yeah. Now, the men in this film, they spoke with such pain and honesty and grace and really beauty in their lives. As you say, it's like a polygraph test. How has the process of making the film and then seeing the film come out and now getting the first reactions to it, How has that affected these five men?
Well, you know, they're all in varying degrees of, shall we say, recovery from PTSD. One of them is very successful, has a good job. Others have modest jobs. One is suffering. It's been a mixed bag for all of them. But the film has been therapeutic. Getting out on the road, not only with us, but with the Innocence Project, has been therapeutic. There was a time from 1989 to 2002 when the word the Central Park Five meant the worst human beings on Earth. Now, for the last 10 years, it's meant something more ambiguous, something confusing, something with undertow. Most people, if they're even aware that the convictions were vacated, think they got off on a technicality. And so what the film does is say, you know what? Being a member of the Central Park Five might actually have a heroic dimension. That, as you say, these five, who could be filled with anger and bitterness, and I'm sure there is some anger, I'm sure there is some bitterness, are themselves struggling to sort of push through this, to heal themselves through the process of telling their story. And for the first time, somebody listened to them. My daughter, back in 2003, you know, 20 years old, they had to trust somebody from the, quote, media, unquote, that had screwed them royally. And it took them a while, and they trusted her. And they read her book, and they read her thesis at college, and they realized, my goodness, somebody's telling it a different way, the way it happened. And then they were happy to cooperate with her book and happy to cooperate with the film. And in the course of it, you can see the layers, like layers of an onion, peeled back as they reveal the pain of it. Some of them have almost near-perfect photographic memory of that night, April 19th, 1989, when their entire lives changed. They had the day off, the next day off from school. It was Passover. There was no school the next day, and so they had they could stay out. And some of their parents, you know, said, go into the park, go play in the park. And there were a whole bunch of kids, some of them not so good kids, who rolled some drunks and hassled some joggers. And one of this other group actually assaulted a man. But they were nowhere near where the jogger was assaulted by this serial sociopath who worked alone, who had assaulted somebody 2 days before. They had his name, and nobody ever followed up. And he went on to rape and actually murder a pregnant woman. It's one of these ghastly, ghastly stories, and yet we have to sit in it. We have to watch and understand our own comfortable complicity in these stories. We bought those tabloids. We shook our heads, black, white, brown. All of us shook our heads and said, oh, such a shame, as the Reverend Calvin Butt says. And, you know, just assuming that the narrative that the police had put forward, the prosecutors were working with, was right. But in fact, it wasn't right. And the first line of defense, the press, didn't do its job in saying, hey, wait a second, the timeline doesn't work out. Wait a second, none of their confessions really adds up. They don't really know what happened. You know, some of them have many people raping her. Some of them have only one person raping them. Some of them having her hit with a brick. Some of them have, you know, they just don't know what happened. They have her dressed in different outfits. They have it near the reservoir when it took place nearly half a mile away in this secluded area that was a favorite haunt of this serial rapist. You know, they didn't do it. And it should have been clear. And if you look after the first trial, they separated it into two different trials, and look at the what should have been a sort of victory celebration on the part of the prosecutors, the lead prosecutor, Elizabeth Lederer, looks sick to her stomach. She just won this trial. She looks sick, as if she already knows. And this is the other dimension that I was mentioning, the polygraphic aspect of this, that has to be acknowledged. You know, people screwed up, but no attention, like Willie Loman was said. Attention wasn't paid. Attention wasn't paid.
Right, and I have to say, I mean, it's a story in so many ways about culture, not only the culture of the police, the culture of the prosecutors in the DA's office, and, you know, here Elizabeth Lederer, she's a Columbia Law School, she's a distinguished lecturer, and the culture of the United States of America, in which we tend to just disrespect young, dark-skinned men, but also the culture of the media, which, as you said, is no longer really investigating. They're just writing down what the police reports say and not even questioning them. And I don't know what is to be done about that.
Yes, well, I think what it is that we have to shout, as we've tried to do, loudly, in a film, and understand that this is got complications. And as I said, you know, we are all complicit in this. We bought the story. We got out of the subway and we paid our 25 cents or 50 cents for the New York Post with its screaming headlines, or the Daily News or Newsday with its screaming headlines, the more modestly poised New York Times. But all of them bought it. All of them said, wait, no one said, wait a second, this doesn't fit. This doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And we allowed them, you know, in a way, as Sarah struggled to tell her story originally, she said that she was thinking of calling her book, which eventually became, as our film is called, The Central Park Five, Born Guilty. Because, you know, particularly as it continues on today with policing policies in New York of stop and frisk, and they're mostly, not mostly, they're all African-American and brown kids. This is a way of making human beings as real, whose lives are as full as yours and mine, less, not human, other, categoricalized. You know, you can put them in this nice little pigeonhole, say, oh, well, that's a black kid, cross to the other side of the street. And as you see from the film, it's a little bit more complicated than that. They're real human beings. They're thoughtful. They have passions. They have understandings. They have wisdom. They've seen things. They're beautiful in a way. Everybody is in this case. It's a complicated story and of human failing and human frailty in all regards. What makes a man rape? What makes, you know, him confess? I mean, in some strange way, the worst and most reprehensible person in this story is the one who had the crisis of conscience. Not the DA, not the cops, not the assistant district attorneys, the prosecutors, not the detectives, not the newspapers, but the serial psychopathic rapist had a crisis of conscience. And had he not confessed, these five would still be attending sex offender things. They would not be able to live wherever they wanted to. They would have to register. They would still be considered the Central Park Five, among the worst human beings on earth.
The film is called The Central Park Five, and we've been talking to co-director and writer of the film, Ken Burns. And I hope that every citizen of the United States of America has the opportunity to see this film and does see this film, that it's shown in every classroom and every law school in the United States. And thank you so much for making it and for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And once again, the film opens today at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts, here in Santa Fe. There's a screening at 12:30 and then again at 8 o'clock tonight, and those times last through the weekend. And you can check the website, ccasantafe.org, for more information, or call 982-1338. You can also read about the Innocence Project at innocenceproject.org. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. And I'd like now to welcome Diane Karp. She is the executive director of the Santa Fe Art Institute. She's with us many Fridays speaking of the arts. Hi.
Good morning there, Charlotte.
How are you surviving?
I am surviving. What a pleasure. Good morning to the whole listening audience, and welcome to 2013.
I know it's colder in probably Minnesota, but it's darn cold out.
It's colder if you think about what's going on up at Angel Fire in Taos. Angel Fire went down to minus 32 last night.
Good heavens.
Here, it's just bitter cold. There, it's like killer cold.
That's just not nice.
But we have all this gorgeous snow, and no one has permission to complain about any form of precipitation.
That's true. We can, however, complain about snow removal or lack thereof.
Well, I think you direct that to the city, but I don't really want to get stuck in the middle of that one today.
Well, we're speaking of the arts.
We are speaking of the arts, and speaking of snow and rain, on Monday evening at 6 o'clock at the Santa Fe Art Institute, we are inaugurating the next 2 years of program, which is gathered around the theme of contested space. And there was a time when the contested spaces were our wild frontiers, and we would argue over who got there first and who could claim it. But with the world being totally Googled and mapped, and I mean not just the Earth, but the whole idea of space being mapped and unraveled and explained and claimed, we suddenly find ourselves in a position where we need to focus on those contested spaces that are part of everyday life. So whether it's political or geopolitical, whether it's social or racial, we decided that for the next 2 years we're going to be talking very seriously about the contested spaces that exist in the world
like
today.
What?
Such as, we'll be bringing in an amazing gentleman in March. His name is Carlin Tapp. He's Navajo. He's a wonderful photographer. And he decided he would go and map Route 66 on his motorcycle and catch those communities who, when the interstate system was developed, were left absolutely on their own, disconnected once again.
Right.
And most of the communities he's interested in are the native communities who developed all of these sort of presentations and marketing strategies that were dependent on Route 66 and having people drive through. You build the interstate and suddenly transportation and movement through the nation becomes a kind of contested space.
Very interesting.
The first one up, however, which is this Monday, the I think it's the 7th of January, at the Santa Fe Art
Happy
Institute.
New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you, too. Is going to be an experiment that the Art Institute decided to try. We have many kinds of programs, and we decided to see how we could interconnect them and build new program. And this one is an example of two artists and a curator who were invited to spend the whole month of January, of December, and much of the month of January at the Art Institute to put together a very interesting exhibition. The artists are Cynthia Hooper, who's from the West Coast, and Hugh Pocock, who's from the East Coast, and it's curated by Patricia Watts, who's the head and founder of Eco Art Space, which is an organization that does art programming around ecological issues. And they are presenting an exhibition that will be up for the whole month of January and a gallery talk on Monday at 6 p.m. when the exhibition opens. And the exhibition is called Shifting Baselines. And what these two artists have been studying is the shifting baselines of water, polar ice caps, oceans, rivers, reservoirs, and the ways in which over time in history we have this odd tendency to move what we call the baseline in order to make things either appear less horrible, less threatening. And so their work is really in video, photography, and installation, as well as some beautiful watercolors. Their exhibition is about giving the viewer the time to actually seriously engage with many of these issues through very, very beautiful images.
Very interesting.
And just like the Ken Burns film that we were just talking about, the idea that the arts give us the leisure of time and space to consider when these things happen and the media makes their decisions and then they get put into the dumpster, into the past, and we don't think about them anymore. So this should be a really interesting exhibition. Hugh Pocock is using snowmelt from New Mexico and some Arctic polar ice that he is presenting. And it's really going to be a fascinating experiment as well as a beautiful exhibition.
And just one more event, which is not part of your series, but the film Chasing Ice at the CCA.
Definitely. I was going to talk about that one, too.
It's really good.
It's an amazing film, and it's definitely one of those films that everyone has to go and see. And another example of exactly what we're talking about. Having the ability to sit for an hour and 10 minutes or an hour and 20 minutes and deeply understand the narrative and the images that constitute the sort of melting polar caps.
Yeah.
And how it affects every one of us every single day and more and more.
Yeah, whether we know it or not. On a completely different note, we've got two kitties of the week.
Oh, two.
Two kitties.
Do they come as a package?
They come as a pair.
Oh, I love
and
that.
And their names, here's some cuteness for you. Their names are Eve and Dawn.
Eve and Dawn. I would have liked...
The morning and the night.
Very sweet. Very sweet.
They're mother and daughter. They're very attached to each other. They're social and gentle cats who both love to sleep in beds and laps. And they would do best in a home without small children. Dawn has short, a short coat with a tortoise shell and tabby markings, and Eve has a short black coat. If you would like to adopt these kitties, call 505-316-2281, email askfelinesandfriends@yahoo.com, or you can go to fandfnm.org. That's Felines and Friends.
Well, for all of you who have pets, we opened by talking about how bitterly cold it is outside. We really need to be thoughtful about the fact that animals can't be left outside in this kind of weather.
Take your dogs in.
Take your dogs
Leave
in.
Leave them in. Take them for a walk.
Exactly.
Don't
exactly.
forget to take them for at least a bathroom break.
Although, goodness knows, I think they're happier being warm than they are being walked in this weather, but they need both.
Yes.
So tonight, what's going on in town is there's some really interesting exhibitions opening at Vivo Contemporary. It's called Giving Voice to Image. It's a collaborative exhibition between New Mexico poets and gallery artists, which means artists that are already part of Vivo Contemporary. It's up there on Canyon Road at 725A. And there's going to be a reception this evening with readings by Lauren Camp.
Yay!
Yay!
And Barbara Rothman. And the reception is from 5 to 7 tonight. So that should be a nice way to end your day, stay warm, and go and look at both some beautiful art and hear some remarkably talented poets read.
And Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow morning at 8:30. 8:30, ladies and gentlemen. I doubt it'll be really warm, but it's worth it to get yourself over to Collected Works Bookstore for the breakfast lecture team presenting an opera breakfast with guest lecturer William Derbyshire, who will present on Le Troyen. I don't know how you say that.
Yes, Le Troyen.
Les Troyens.
It's the Met Opera's revival of the great Berlioz, Les Troyens.
Okay,
which
Les
is,
Troyens.
It's the saga of the Trojan War, which comes from Virgil's Aeneid. And it's not often presented and staged. And the ability for us to be able to go over to the Lensic after stopping at Collected Works.
It's not based on the Iliad?
No, it's on the Aeneid, okay. As far as I know. I may be wrong. I'm often wrong.
Anyway,
but you should start the morning at Collected Works. They have outstanding coffee, great pastries. They even have breakfast burritos.
And the screening is at 10 at the Lensic.
Exactly, and then the screening is at 10, and I think that's a really lovely way to start a cold Saturday morning. I recommend it highly.
And then Sundays in January from 3 to 5 in the afternoon, Lorianne Fiorentino will be back with live music performance. And she's a wonderful performer. And Children's Story Time is every Wednesday and Thursday morning at 11:45. And that is fun for the kids.
Fun for the kids. So if you can't get to the opera in HD at the Lensic on Saturday morning, they're going to be screening it again at 2 p.m. on Sunday. Although
nice.
You won't have the wonderful pleasure of the breakfast lecture at Collected Works. But also on Sunday.
Well, you could.
What? You could. That's right. You could stop it at any time at
you
Collected
can,
Works.
You are
always.
You are free.
You are
free
always
men
welcome.
And women.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely. Performance at the screen on Sunday. They have a marvelous series, and they're going to continue that performance at the screen series. Which the screen is on the campus of the University of Art and Design, and that is the Bolshoi Ballet production of La Sylphide,
nice.
Which is at 11 a.m. on Sunday morning. So you could go to see La Sylphide and then go on to see the Met Live. Really interesting Sunday. But another thing that you might want to think about if you're not up for going to the screen to see performances of the Bolshoi Ballet is Common Cause is the voting rights director of Common Cause and the former Green Party candidate Diane Wood and Rick Lass are going to be talking about legislative issues with our own local Farron dancer at 11 a.m. at Collected Work Bookstore. Another really, really interesting thing to put on your list of activities for Sunday.
Considering there is a legislative session coming up,
yes.
which is 60 days in which legislation will be passed.
We hope.
Something will be passed.
We certainly hope so. A lot came to the floor last year. Very little got passed.
Well, but last year was a 30-day session.
That's right.
They're not supposed
That's
to
right.
do anything except the budget.
Yeah. You're right.
The budget.
What am I know? I have high hopes all the time. Another thing on Sunday, Bobby Sundberg, who is the curator over at the International Folk Art Museum, and Joyce Chaney are going to be talking together in the closing program of Young Brides, Old Treasures, Macedonian Embroidery, Embroidered Dresses, from 1 to 4 over there at Museum Hill.
Very nice.
It's a beautiful exhibition. It's been up for a long time. If you didn't get to see it, catch it before it closes. And while you're there, you can pick up the chocolate mate y mas.
Yes.
Which is another really nice exhibition.
Yeah. How many museum shows on chocolate have you seen?
Well, exactly. I love the opening events with all the different kinds of chocolate.
Yeah.
But you can also, if you stop in the shop, they have chocolate, hot chocolate, in little cups that you
nice.
Can sample
Yum.
And buy and take home.
They've got good museum shops up there.
They do.
And before the screening of Chasing Ice tonight, there is a film by a local filmmaker named Eileen Torpy, and it's called Ocean Keeper. So that's at 7:30 tonight, and it's one night only at the
CCA?
CCA.
Oh, cool.
Yep.
Cool. Besides Monday night, coming to the Santa Fe Art Institute to hear the two artists give a gallery talk and see the exhibition, Shifting Baselines. There are some other interesting things. They have a Breakfast with O'Keefe talk and morning event from 8:30. A lot of things are going on early in the morning next week. 8:30 to 9:45 at the O'Keefe Museum. The various staff members are going to be talking about careers in museum work. And, you know, it's a kind of nice way to personalize those very smart, very competent people who run the museums in Santa Fe.
Yeah, so. Very smart and competent indeed.
Yes, indeed. So stop over and have a chance to meet them and see them. For me, the big deal this week, besides the exhibition and gallery talk at the Art Institute on Monday night, is that starting on Wednesday, StoryCorps, which is an unbelievable project that was begun, oh my gosh, I think begun like 11 years ago. The national nonprofit organization that records interviews with everyday Americans, people who live and work in our country. And they're going to be recording on the plaza in an Airstream trailer parked on Palace Avenue on the plaza from Wednesday the 9th of January through February 9th. And
yes.
It's just remarkable. They're all kept in the Library of Congress, and it's a way of recording the diversity of stories and voices from the incredibly complex diversity of the people who live and work here in the United States.
And what you do is you go in pairs. So let's say mother and daughter, or uncle and nephew, or two sisters, or two good friends who've known each other a long time, or whatever. You go in there in pairs, and one asks the other person questions, and then that story is recorded. And there's a facilitator there who will help you if you need help, or if you get stuck, or anything like that, and they've got wonderful equipment. And this gets archived forever, and you get a copy of it, and I think for a lot of people, it's a family document that never would have been there for them otherwise.
There's no doubt, not only for their own family, but for the American populace in general. You know, we hang with the people often who are just like us, and they have similar experiences, and they have similar mindsets. To hear the voices of people from all walks of life and all levels of the economy and all cultures and all races is such a gift. I grew up in a household where my father would often say that an enemy is someone whose story you don't know.
Right.
And that concept of hearing people in their own voices tell their stories and record them for posterity is phenomenal. So if anyone
it's like
out there...
Studs Terkel.
Studs Terkel, absolutely. But
I always say Studs Terkel because that's the name of my car.
But Studs wrote, and so the actual voice...
Well, he did radio, too.
Oh, he did do radio.
Yeah, yeah.
You're absolutely right. But the point is, if there's someone that you know and love who has a remarkable story that you would like to record and keep and share, you need to go online, and you need to call 800-850 4406, or you can go online to StoryCorps, StoryCorps, .org, and you make a reservation, and then you can go down and record. And I think this is really important. You know, New Mexico doesn't always have much of a visibility in national coverage. In fact, I'm always amazed that when you look at the weather in any city or state other than New Mexico, the weather person is always standing right in front of New Mexico. So you can't see the state.
And can we also just say that this is sponsored by KSFR?
Yes, it is indeed sponsored by KSFR.
K Santa Fe Radio.
Exactly. Okay, so Thursday, and you can record these all the way through till the 9th of February, so get online,
yeah,
make
get
a phone
on it.
Call, make a reservation.
It goes by faster than you think.
Yeah. Thursday in concert will be Greg Brown. He's an Americana singer and songwriter performing at 7:30 at the St. Francis Auditorium at the New Mexico Museum of Art. And there's a wonderful book talk on Thursday as well. The Santa Fe Botanical Gardens are having their winter lecture series.
Nice.
And that's really a wonderful contribution to Santa Fe. It's from 2 to 4 p.m. It's going to be, the lecture will be, and talk will be presented at the Museum of International Folk Art. And you can call for reservations. And it's going to, this winter lecture series is going to continue on the second Thursday of each month all the way through April. So learn a little bit about indigenous plants and about the flora of your own landscape.
The flora, which is not as easy to see today as it would be in the warmer weather. Hey, lots of dancing and music. I've got
a nice email
with a beautiful list that is telling us that Chifo Sanchez and Smoking Hot is at El Mesón tonight.
Yes.
Cody Wayne Country Music is at Taos Mesa Brewing Company in Taos. There is Santa Rueda at the Odd Fellows with Carlos Mora, wonderful dancer, from 6 to 9, and then Salsa at the Lodge at 9. The Sean Heelan Band is at the Cowgirl tonight at 8:30. Flamenco Fridays at La Boca with Julia Chacon and Inspiración Flamenca. There's Country Nights at Buffalo Thunder. There's Stephanie Hatfield and Hot Mess at Taos Inn. Lots of good stuff all over Santa Fe and Albuquerque and Taos. Lots of good dancing and stuff like that. And that was just Friday. So there's good stuff on through the weekend. Check out your Pasatiempo and your reporter and get your dancing and music listings.
Absolutely. There, you know, again, we find ourselves in that marvelous situation where we're talking about the incredible richness of the programming that's available in Santa Fe.
In a town this small.
In a town this small. And we need to, you know, give a heads up and a shout out to all of the people that run all these organizations.
Yep.
Because without them, this richness wouldn't be here. And to KSFR and to you in particular, Mary Charlotte, for being so able to bring all of this to the community in such a generous and direct way.
And all of our music DJs.
All of
this
our
is
music
such a,
DJs,
everyone
yes.
thinks, you know, we do talk and news, which we do, but we've got so many amazing music DJs, and a lot of them let us know about this stuff, too. So keep the radio on, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, indeed.
And it's not just jazz. I mean, there's jazz during the day, but there's in the afternoon, there's kind of variety programs, and in the evenings, it just goes wild.
Absolutely. In fact, it's a good thing to have on all the time, and you could tune it in and turn it up when it's something you really want to hear, and have it be a remarkable background when you don't.
There we have it.
So what are you going, did you make any New Year's revolutions?
Revolutions, yes. Did I make any New Year's resolutions? Yeah, I always do, but I never keep them. I think.
Are they always the same, or do you make new ones each year?
You know, I would have to write them down in order to tell you the answer to that, and then be able to find a piece of paper. Let's see.
I've seen your office.
You don't want to have seen my office. Let's see. I think health and things like that.
Good. Taking care of yourself.
Yeah.
Taking care of the people around you.
Sleep.
Taking care of the land. You bet. Taking care. That's my.
That's yours.
That's my resolution for 2013.
That's a good one.
Yeah, yeah. It works. It opens your mind to think of ways of breaking old habits. And
it's hard to break old habits.
Well, that
you want to form good habits.
Yes, and they're the ones that are most challenging, obviously. But when we have friends around us and family around us who help us to see our little blind spots, they're not blind spots anymore. We get to see what we're doing.
And they're glaring errors.
Well, sometimes glaring errors, sometimes, you know, wonderful things. Blind spots can be good and bad.
Well, so taking care of ourselves, each other, our community, our planet. And
getting out into the landscape more.
Yeah.
So we have all of the wonderful Lannan cultural freedom and readings and conversations that are coming up.
Yep.
We have the Telluride Mountain film coming to Santa Fe on tour, which is just, you know, talking about getting out into the landscape.
Yeah.
They take us out into the
Take us out of the landscape.
Thank you so
I know,
much.
And the thing that's tricky about that is you can actually sit on your comfortable plush chair and feel like you've been extreme skiing.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think in many ways that's the whole idea of the power of the arts.
Yep. That
not only do they show you the detail, but they show you the grand scale.
The grand scale.
The grand scale. And coming up as well is the Super Bowl, one of my favorite Santa Fe project.
And we're not talking about the athletic
contest.
We're
not talking about the football. We're talking about the soup, as in S-O-U-P, Super Bowl. And it's the Food Depot's annual fundraiser. All of the ceramicists in town make beautiful bowls and mugs and cups, and you get to pick one out. You could pick out a lot of them if you want and buy it. And then you can walk around and sample all of the fabulous soups made by so many of the incredibly talented chefs here in Santa Fe.
Saturday, January 26th at 2:30 at the Santa Fe Convention Center, and I just found out I'm going to be one of the MCs.
Oh, baby.
Literally and figuratively.
Yeah, I like that. That's great. It is one of my favorite Santa Fe events. I love Pancakes on the Plaza, and I love the Super Bowl. And the thing that I like best about the Super Bowl is the amount of generosity that goes into it. The chefs provide all the soup and their restaurants and their organizations. The ceramicists provide all of the cups and bowls, and all of the money goes to the Food Depot, which is the center for food distribution in northern New Mexico for families and organizations that would otherwise go hungry.
Exactly. Wonderful, wonderful organization. And like many of the organizations in town, they would like to render themselves unnecessary.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But as they are necessary, this is probably the most painless way of being generous yourself. It's not expensive to get in. You can buy a bunch of bowls that are wonderful gifts, or you can just keep them for yourself. And you can know that you are hanging out with the community. It's another thing that I love about it, like Pancakes on the Plaza. Everybody shows up. So you've got all walks of life, everybody sort of sharing in support of the Food Depot.
And I'm listening to the music, which means it's time to go. Diane Karp is Executive Director of the Santa Fe Art Institute, which is on the web at Hasta la... Go ahead.
Hasta la vista.
Yeah, but I'm not done yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'll get out of the way.
They're on the web at sfai.org at Santa Fe Art Institute. And again, wonderful programming going on over there. And we are streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thank you so much to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today, and thanks to all the awesome KSFR staff and volunteers and board. It's a wonderful organization. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz. Have a wonderful weekend, ladies and gentlemen. Stay warm. Be kind to your animals and each other. Get out into this beautiful town. Diane, have a great one.
Thank you very much.
And
you too, Mary Charlotte.
We'll see you next week.
Hasta la vista.
Ciao.
Ciao.